Hello, everyone. It's Steve Baker, the pragmatic insurrectionist, constitutionalist. I'm not exactly sure why I made that Freudian slip, but maybe it's related to the content that's coming up here today. On today's podcast, I'm probably going to ultimately piss off a few people, maybe lose a couple of friends, or at the very least lose the potential for new friends. But in my case, what else is new? It's kind of like my relationship to President Trump, because I would never offer my unconditional fealty to the man. It always stunted, you know, the growth of my readership. Similarly, because after he was elected, specifically, I didn't remain opposed to every single action and utterance that the purest libertarians wanted me to do, and therefore some of my following actually, well, they left me in droves during that period. The fact is, when Trump hit, when he hit a home run, like the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, let's say, he always, in those cases, he earned a hashtag good Trump from me. And when he completely and utterly dropped the ball on, like, the pandemic and how he handled that and keeping Fauci on and that sort of thing, I called bad Trump as required. And I've always said that TDS, you know what TDS is, the Trump derangement syndrome. I've always said that it exists on both sides. For those of you who believe that Trump could never do any wrong, I called you a Trumpaholic. And for those who believe that Trump was the root of all evil, a racist, a homophobe, and the spawn of Hitler himself, I called you, well, a Democrat. Neither characterization is correct coming from either side about Trump. And the end result of my more pragmatic issue-by-issue analysis of his presidency basically left me as kind of a man without a country, or at the very least a man without a party, or probably without 100 times more readership and followership than I've currently garnered. But by being less pragmatic and more sectarian, less extreme in my views, and not picking a side on every single issue, well, you tend to find yourself in a nether region, so to speak, politically, and it is what it is. And the reality is, I'm not going to change. I am what I am. I am who I am. So anyway, today I'm going to get some things off my chest about and regarding the whole saga of the Stephen Colbert Cruz not being charged by the Department of Justice for violating direct orders from the Capitol Police to leave the building. But I'm probably going to comment on this and offer analysis on this in a manner, and for four reasons, that you probably wouldn't suspect. Then I'm going to also give you some commentary on a new, brand new, January 6th documentary that just came out this week. And that's by those who were probably soon to, you know, no longer be my friends as well. Anyway, that's the way it is. But first, let me quickly get the commercial announcements out of the way before I dive into this. Please consider joining our community on Locals, the pragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. Go to Locals, look up the Pragmatic Constitutionalist, or you can download the app from your app store and look up at TPC4USA. The handle is at TPC4USA. If you do that, you're never, ever, ever going to again miss anything that we put out. Unlike Facebook, Twitter, it's the only place where you can be sure to receive all of TPC's content, period. We're never shadow banned or suspended or having warning labels put on our posts there. There's no ads that you have to sift through. You can sign up for free, and you can then see every single thing that we put out, assuming that you set up your notifications correctly. Then, if you choose to become a supporting member for as little as $5 a month, then you'll see even more supporter-exclusive content as well. Yes, we do still have two Facebook pages. We're on Twitter, Parler, Gab, MeWe, all of our videos on Rumble. We are no longer putting and posting and uploading content to YouTube. And then, of course, all of our podcasts are also available on all the major podcast platforms. But every single thing that we do has its origins, begins, and starts in our Locals community. So once again, thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. And please, wherever you're seeing, hearing, watching, or reading even the transcript to this particular podcast, be sure that you subscribe, like, follow, or share, whatever options are available there, because those are important and they do help us with all the algorithms. And, well, you hear this from everybody. If you watch and listen to podcasts, everybody says that, and there's a reason for that. So please do that. Subscribe, like, follow, share, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, here we go. Commercials out of the way. Let's dive into this and let's piss a few people off. I've gotten in a lot of trouble for some of my January 6th related analysis because I will not immediately accept reporting or narratives that I haven't seen with my own eyes or confirmed from multiple sources. I've also been willing to change my opinion of a specific incident when new evidence presents itself. And then I actually publicly say so. Hey, I was wrong, or I changed my mind, or I see things differently now. This often leaves me at odds with other journalists on both sides of the prevailing political landscape. In this particular article or podcast, depending upon whether you're reading, listening, or watching this, I'm going to take you through my thoughts on the Colbert crew case, as well as offer some comments about the new January 6th documentary. It's called Bloody Hill, that was released a few days ago. But first, let me just kind of set the stage for this whole thing. One particular and very important perspective of mine has never changed, and that is that my earliest contention that the frontline United States Capitol Police officers were actually used as nothing more than pawns by those who were up the chain that day. When I say pawns, I mean P-A-W-N-S, pawns, like a chess match. And that they were used as pawns by those who were orchestrating the flow of the day to establish a desired narrative. I've even been very clear that I believe that those up the chain were willing to sacrifice Capitol Police officers' lives for that agenda, had those with more, you know, violent and nefarious intentions actually showed up with firearms that day rather than just bringing sticks, flagpoles, and bear spray. In fact, one NBC News affiliate investigative reporter who interviewed me after he read my earliest articles about J6, and he did his research in advance. He actually asked me on camera if I really believed that the powers that be up the chain were actually willing to sacrifice Capitol Police officers' lives in order to establish their narrative of an attempted political coup or insurrection. And I gave him an unqualified yes, absolutely, I do believe that, and I still do, even after a year and a half that I've spent poring over reams of data and information and research and hundreds of hours of video evidence from January 6th, I still believe that to be true. Maybe even more so now than ever before. That's not to say that there weren't some really bad actors amongst those Capitol Police officers and DC Metro Police officers who were battling the violent agitators that day. But let's be perfectly clear. The Capitol Police did not fire the first shot. That is an errant assumption and assertion by many out there on the right. That occurred, the first shot actually occurred at the initial barricade breach. And when I say shot, I mean the first violence that took place that day. That occurred at the initial barricade breach where the likes of Ray Epps and other of those unindicted provocateurs violently rushed against the very small handful of police that were protecting what they call a bike rack fence line. And it was clearly marked, big sign, closed area. And when the Capitol Police officer, Carolyn Edwards, was pushed against from the other side of that bike rack, she was seriously injured by those very same provocateurs. And in that initial surge, she was pushed backwards. She was upended, knocked unconscious, and this happened when her head hit the concrete step that was behind her. So the very first acts of violence and aggressive provocations did not come from the Capitol Police, as many assert. I've always contended that the event itself, right there in that first breach, was enough justification for those officers to have actually drawn their weapons to protect themselves as well as the building that they were charged to protect. That didn't happen, and I've always wanted to know why. Instead, that particular group of officers there at the first breach, they gathered up the injured Carolyn Edwards, and then they retreated back towards the Capitol building while the small group of protesters themselves then broke in a run toward the Capitol building. And this was happening as some in that number of initial provocateurs and protesters or rioters, whatever you want to call them, then began the process of disassembling all of the bike racks, the plastic fencing, and they took the area closed signs, they turned them over, and they made sure that they hid those. And they were doing this in advance of the thousands of people that would be later coming that way so that they couldn't see those signs and see that fencing and see those bike rack barricades. And all of this that I'm talking about right now is irrefutably documented by multiple video accounts. And of course, we know that those will never be shown to the public by the January 6th House Select Committee. So after the Capitol police officers retreated and then retrenched there on the Capitol's west side terrace, and then as larger groups began to gather behind those who were already pressing the defensive line that the police had set up, only then did the police actually begin launching crowd control munitions and other types of crowd control devices into the middle of actually more peaceful observers that were standing back and watching what was taking place on the actual battle line. So I said all that to set this up. The detailed offenses of the Late Show with Stephen Colbert crew, which I'm not going to go into those detailed maneuverings and offenses right here, right now. We all know about them. We've read about them. And if you're unfamiliar, Google it. But what they were doing, let's be honest, what the Colbert crew, or as they call the Colbert Nine, what they were doing did not rise to the level of another so-called insurrection. If we don't want what the Trump rally attendees did on that day to be called an insurrection, we certainly can't call this Colbert camera crew, comedy crew, if that was their intent to do something funny there, an insurrection either. That word insurrection means something, and it's been used by far too many on our side of the whole January 6th debate and investigations, and it shouldn't be. As widely reported, even by mainstream media news agencies, the Colbert group most certainly were in violation of multiple direct orders by the United States Capitol Police to leave the areas where and when that they did not have permission for their continued presence, whatever their purpose and whatever their alleged justification for being there. As such, the Capitol Police issued an appropriate response regarding their displeasure with the Department of Justice refusal to follow through with charges and prosecution of the Colbert Nine. They did their job. They told them to leave at least three times. The Colbert Nine refused to leave, snuck around, went other places, got caught doing so. And then, of course, the Department of Justice, unlike the other types of trespassers on January 6th, they were not charged. Any investigations into what they were doing was dropped. And, of course, the Capitol Police expressed their displeasure for literally ignoring the multiple orders to vacate those premises and therefore also the violations by the Colbert Nine. Now, by contrast, as I said, the vast majority of the peaceful protesters who entered the Capitol building after the Capitol Police and the D.C. Metro Police were ordered to stand down on January 6th, and then the violent perpetrators had breached the building through broken windows and this larger crowd that followed received no such instructions from law enforcement to vacate the premises, do not enter, leave immediately. In fact, as we are aware, and this is factually indisputable, most of those protesters who had arrived for the rally at the Ellipse and at the Washington Monument lawn, who made their way over to the Capitol that day for an organized march and for other events that were actually scheduled and for which permits had been applied for by the Park Police and other whatever other agencies those are supposed to be submitted to. These people who arrived later, they did not see any resistance. They were met with no resistance. They were met with no police whatsoever as they came over. There were no do not enter warnings or do not enter signs from the police as they approached, even later, the open doors of the Capitol. Now, my own personal experience is actually instructive in this regard. So let me digress a little bit and go back and review of some of that. I actually entered the open Northwest Capitol building door at about 2:19 p.m. of that day. And this was only a few minutes after the initial breach on that side. But I didn't witness either the breach itself or any resistance from law enforcement after there was an obvious pullback or a stand down order given to the Capitol Police and also there's the support that they were receiving from the DC Metro officers. I first observed, after I went up the steps from the terrace, several dozen police officers standing off to the side. They were chatting amongst themselves, or they were talking on their cell phones, or they were texting their wives, probably to let them know that they were okay, because they surely knew that everybody was seeing this on national television everywhere. And none of those police whatsoever were interacting in any way with the gathering crowd and ultimately hundreds of protesters that were making their way up to the Capitol level where that door was open. And they were certainly, as I said before, offering no resistance, and not one of them was issuing any commands, do not enter, you can't go in there, stay out, whatever. The door itself that I went through had clearly been opened from the inside, and I had no knowledge whatsoever that it had actually been illegally and violently breached only a few minutes earlier. It was not actually until later analysis of my own video that I saw the window of that very door had been shattered. As I was in the moment at the time, I was just concentrating on capturing the ongoing events with my camera. So there was a lot of details I missed. I was just focusing on filming rather than observing things until later when I reviewed all my videos. At least 100 others similarly passed through that same door unimpeded and without warning before I walked through. There was no possible way whatsoever before I arrived, or before any of these other latter assembled protesters had arrived, to make any assumption other than that the Capitol Police had themselves, for whatever reason, been ordered to stand down and to allow the crowd to enter the Capitol at their leisure. And that's exactly what happened. Given what we could see with our eyes, which was like an obvious stand-down posture from the Capitol Police officers, that was the only assumption that could be made. So, as it happened, skipping forward, less than 45 minutes later, while I was in the lower level of the south side of the building, now on the completely other side, there was a female officer who took me by my arm. I've recounted this in multiple stories. And she politely said to me, "Sir, may I safely escort you out of the building?" And I responded in complete compliance and gave her no resistance whatsoever. And this, of course, is the exact opposite of what the Colbert crew did. And that is the reason for which they should be prosecuted, charged and prosecuted. To not prosecute them for their defiant behavior is a clear double standard by the Department of Justice as compared to the largest number of people who have been charged and prosecuted for unknowingly trespassing or entering restricted space in the Capitol building that day. So the exaggerated use of that word insurrection applied to the Colbert crew and then thrown around by, you know, certain of those on our side of the debate, frankly, it does nothing to help our cause. It actually diminishes our efforts when much more logical and reasonable arguments can be made in pointing out the egregious double standards and selective prosecutions being made by the Department of Justice in most January 6 related cases. Along those same lines, and I'm certainly, as I said before, going to offend somebody with my continued remarks from this point forward. Yesterday, I watched that new documentary that's put out by StopHate.com. It's entitled Bloody Hill. Frankly, to be perfectly honest, I'm not impressed. And especially, I'm especially disconcerted by several of the quote-unquote facts and assertions that they present in this particular documentary. First of all, several times, they make the claim that 2 million or millions of people had gathered in D.C. on January 6th, that day for the rally. And look, that's just a gross exaggeration of the crowd size. My personal estimation, which I devoted a 22-minute video in describing, and that ultimately was a crowd size that I estimated between 400,000 and 600,000 people. Now, I came to that estimate not by pulling a number out of my rear end or just by some estimate by looking out with my own eyes. I actually came to that estimate using known formulas that were supplied to me by military sources for actually estimating large numbers of people that were assembled on the published acreage of both the Ellipse lawn and the Washington Monument lawn. Now, as more data and more reliable information and more video has emerged since that day and since my earliest reporting of the event, especially regarding the much smaller area of the Ellipse that was actually used to accommodate a crowd, and in fact, the limits that Trump himself complained about that were placed on the crowd size in the Ellipse area, I've actually downgraded my original estimate of the overall size of between 400 to 600,000 people to somewhere between 250 and 400,000. Now, certainly, no more than a half a million. So let's say a half a million at the most. Still, that's not a shabby number, certainly nothing to be ashamed of, and certainly not a number that requires some, you know, hyperbolic exaggeration to enhance the story of the day, especially considering that this was a midweek event on a Wednesday, a work day for most of those in attendance. So an exaggeration of in the millions or 2 million is just simply not necessary by the documentarians. The Bloody Hill documentary continues for most of its duration in doing what I think is the most egregious part of the story. They were essentially painting the entirety of the Capitol Police Force as nothing more, nothing short of just pure murderous thugs. That's not my experience. It's not what I witnessed. It's certainly not what I captured on my own video. I observed dozens of police officers getting the utter shit kicked out of them by very violent assaults from many of the agitators on the crowd side. And as I've reported numerous times, what I observed over the course of my hour videoing and what was taking place on the West Terrace, all of that eventually elicited from me the number one question about January 6th, and that is, who ordered the Capitol Police to not use more aggressive defense measures in protecting themselves and protecting the Capitol and protecting the occupants therein? Because based on my own observations, I saw many acts of potentially deadly force used against the police that should have warranted a response using their own far more deadly and decisively crowd-stopping weapons that they were all carrying on their hips. You see, my conclusion has always been that those police officers, the U.S. Capitol Police, the D.C. Metro Police, who arrived to support the Capitol Police, my conclusion has always been that they were ordered not to respond with appropriate measure as a group. And quite frankly, for a year and a half now, continued in amazement in my own memories by the constraint that those police officers individually displayed during certain of the attacks that they had to endure themselves. Now, that said, and as I mentioned before, there were most definitely examples where individual police officers did in fact aggressively and unnecessarily respond, even beating certain protesters unnecessarily. One lady, as is covered in the Bloody Hill documentary, was later beaten to death by an officer during the West tunnel violence episode. There were two other men covered in the documentary who were most certainly injured and suffered either heart attacks or some other fatal injuries that were the direct result of those flashbang grenades that were launched over the heads of the, you know, the violent perpetrators on the front line and into the crowd of just the peaceful observers where they were. I was actually hit in the leg by one of those grenades. Actually, it exploded probably about 2 or 3 feet off to my right. The shrapnel from that explosion hit my leg, and I, for weeks thereafter, had the bruises to show for it. Now, as I was not engaged in any violent behavior myself, and in that moment was not even among the perpetrators of the violence on the front line, and certainly I was attempting no breach of the police line, I should not have been the target, and none of those who were around me should have been the target of a flashbang grenade. That was, and I've captured that on my own videos and showed it, a particular officer who seemed to be having a great time with that particular weapon was gleefully launching those grenades over the violent perpetrators and into the larger crowd that was doing nothing more than observing what was going on. Now, my first encounter with a police officer that day was actually inside the building, and it was a Capitol Police officer who was carrying an automatic rifle, and he was in the process of donning his own protective gear and helmet and all of that, and he was doing so right in front of the House Ways and Means Committee chamber doorway. I saw this, and I walked right up to him, and I asked him, point blank, it's on my video. I said, are you planning on using that on us? And by using that, I was referring to the rifle. And he responded, I don't want to. Not if I don't have to. Seconds later, I could hear the police radios going off, chaotically squawking, shots fired, and other warnings and messages received by a group of officers that were gathered inside of a huge stairwell area, almost like a stairwell lobby next to the House of Representatives chamber. And I was unaware myself at this moment that only a minute or so earlier that Ashley Babbitt had been shot by Officer Michael Byrd. And this was just on the other side of that large stairwell area where I was now videoing the unfolding reactions, as I said, by about a dozen or so gathered Capitol Police officers. Almost all of whom at this point now had their weapons drawn for the first time that day. One officer in particular ran up to a handful of us that were gathering and attempting to move into that stairwell area to stop us and keep us from proceeding any further, because on the other side was where the shooting had taken place. And so there was a just immense confusion in that moment, and the cops, a few of them who I actually recognized from the West Terrace battle line, they were clearly shaken and frightened themselves. They did not know what was going on in the confusion of the moment. And the officer who approached me asked if any of us had guns. And I told him, I said, no, we have cameras. And so he then, a few seconds later, he kind of calmed down. And then he began curiously saying something to us, which was very interesting. And again, it's all captured on my camera. He said, it's not us. It's not us. And this was as if he was trying to assure us that they were not the problem in this moment. He was taking some deep breaths to calm himself. And even in that moment of intense chaos and confusion, the reality was is that he was professionally trying to assure us that the scene we were now observing was not the result of their actions. Now, I later discovered from their own radio alerts that they were, in fact, in the moment under the impression that those shots that had been fired, shots fired, plural, but we now know it was a singular shot, but they were under the impression that the shots fired that they were hearing on the radios had come from protesters and not that single shot that had been fired by Officer Byrd at Ashley Babbitt. So you can understand their confusion and their anxiety and their fear in the moment. As that scene was unfolding, several ATF police tactical unit officers were arriving with automatic weapons, and they began patting down certain of the protesters. They were looking for weapons. And then I counted more than two dozen DC Metro police coming up from the lower level into that area to support whatever was happening. Now, humorously, it was during this time of heightened physical and emotional intensity that I inquired from a female Capitol Police officer where there might be a restroom. And she told me that she was not familiar with that area of the building, but she politely said that I could look downstairs if I wanted to, and she pointed in that direction, so off I went. And then minutes later, while I was then the only civilian in that lower south side level of the Capitol building, that I observed several members of an FBI tactical unit feverishly working to save Ashley Babbitt's life, just literally 6 feet from where I was. And it was through that same door where I was being led out by the officer I'd previously mentioned, who asked me if she could safely escort me out of the building, that at the same time we arrived at that south side exit door, that the EMT group was coming in to take Ashley Babbitt out. And now, as another aside, and this is quite frankly directed at you rabid conspiracy theorists that might be listening to this, although I don't know how many of you still follow anything that I do, but I will tell you right here, right now, authoritatively, that Ashley Babbitt was no crisis actor. What I witnessed with my own eyes as the only civilian in that location was not a show. There were no cameras aimed at those officers who were desperately trying to save and help Babbitt. And I wasn't even using mine at the time. There were only law enforcement officers present and just myself. As I said, the sole civilian to observe that actual scene. And those officers had absolutely no awareness of my presence at the time, save for the female Capitol Police officer who was escorting me towards that exit door with her shaking hand on my right arm. That was it. So the Bloody Hill documentary, in my opinion, paints the Capitol Police and the other law enforcement divisions that were there that day with far too broad of a brush. And my more rational, pragmatic observations and reporting don't make me a bootlicker either. And when I say bootlicker, as I'm often accused of being, I only convey what I saw with my own eyes, captured with my own camera, and relay the specific interactions that I personally had with police officers that day. Still, admittedly, I was pretty shaken up after all that I had witnessed. My initial emotional response to what I observed in those, you know, highly kinetic moments led me to, frankly, to similar initial conclusions about police overreach. And I even did a video talking about it the evening of January 6th from my hotel room. But then I spent the next 5 days doing frame by frame analysis of my own videos, which led to a much more reasoned conclusion about what I had experienced, and quite frankly, even deeper questions about the Capitol Police actions that day than is even covered by that documentary. And some of those questions are this. I mean, first of all, why did those Capitol Police officers so readily cede that first barricade? And why did they cede so easily that line, especially after one of their own was so seriously injured during that first breach? Next question, why did they not respond to the West terrorist violence with far more aggressive defensive force? Is not the Capitol building supposed to be one of the most secure government facilities in the world? I mean, especially considering that the Vice President of the United States and all of our Congress were present at the time. Also, how is it possible that only 225 violent perpetrators, that number is the number given by the Department of Justice. Again, not a number I pulled out of my ass. How is it possible that only just over 200 violent perpetrators with nothing more than sticks, flagpoles, and bear spray overwhelm a fully armed police force made up of the Capitol Police and DC Metro Police? Additionally, why did the assembled tactical units that were there under the command of the FBI, including the FBI's own tactical unit, ATF Tactical Unit, U.S. Marshal Service Tactical Unit, as well as members of the Army's Special Forces who had, quote-unquote, shoot-to-kill orders, according to Newsweek, why were they not assisting the Capitol Police in defending the Capitol against such a small number of violent agitators? Next question. Why did not the four or five Capitol police officers who were just inside that very first West Side window that was busted out and breached, why did they not draw their weapons and prevent those first rioters from jumping inside and opening the adjacent door? Instead, those officers, they ran away like scared children. And we've been able to see this because the Capitol Police or the Justice Department has released the inside closed circuit television camera of that entire episode. So we've seen it all in high definition. It's very clear what took place. We saw from the inside, we saw the breach of the window, the broken window. We saw one of those officers came up with a small can of pepper spray and sprayed it and then joined the other three or four that were there in the hallway. And they ran off like scared children and hid. At the very least, why did they not draw their weapons and aim those weapons at those who were intending to come through the window while also obviously shouting orders to stop or cease and desist or do not enter, whatever the case? And this was an action that most certainly would have stopped those rioters from coming through the window. At the very worst, of course, had those rioters continued their forward progress against such orders and against those drawn weapons, let's be honest, a couple of what I consider to be legally justified shots could have been fired, and then no one would have entered the Capitol that day, at least not through that window and the adjacent doorway. Furthermore, there would not have been any protesters, those having entered from the west side, who then would later open doors on the east side from the inside approximately 11 or 12 minutes later. Had they done their job at that west side breached window, no one would have entered the Capitol that day. Final question is, who up the chain ordered the Capitol Police not to adequately defend themselves or defend the building? I mean, who ordered them to stand down and then to allow the protesters to enter without proper, legal, and what I believe to be justifiably necessary force to protect the Capitol and its occupants? I mean, at least not until the desired narrative had been secured, and until, of course, Ashley Babbitt had been killed and the bloody West Tunnel battle then later ensued. The fact is, if the United States Capitol Police and the DC Metro Police, along with the assembled FBI, ATF, and U.S. Marshal tactical units, not to mention the embedded Army Special Forces in the crowd that day, if they had been allowed or ordered to do their actual jobs of defending the capital of the United States, the seat of our own government, with the overwhelming defensive weapons that they had at their disposal, the Capitol building would not have been breached. Hundreds of innocent people would not have faced federal prosecution and had their lives either upended or completely ruined, at the very least. And, of course, Ashley Babbitt would still be alive today. Also, the subsequent tunnel battle that happened sometime thereafter also would likely have never happened, along with its accompanying an additional loss of life in that episode. I can't help but also draw the conclusion that had those law enforcement agencies been allowed to do their jobs, there would not also have been this subsequent spate of Capitol Police and DC Metro Police officers who committed suicide in the weeks following January 6th. So to me, it does in fact seem apparent that those up the chain did in fact offer and sacrifice all those lost lives in order to achieve their desired narrative. In conclusion, and with regards to the Bloody Hill documentary, in their presentation of a long list of suspicious deaths and subsequent suicides of protesters, police officers, and other characters involved with January 6th, the filmmakers also added the recent passing of then Sergeant of Arms Michael Stinger. I wrote an exhaustive article on his death. It was not suspicious. It was not a suicide. He was not shot in some black op, to prevent him from testifying before the surprise House Select Committee hearing on the day following his death. His passing was in no way related to January 6th whatsoever. all such conspiratorial reporting was invented out of thin air. He had been suffering from cancer for an unknown length of time, and he was not the surprise witness scheduled for that particular hearing. So appropriately, his family wanted no part in the January 6th bullshit to be a part of their grieving process. So they quietly announced his death of natural causes and end of statement. So he shouldn't have been included in this documentary in that list of suspicious deaths. Finally, Bloody Hill uses one of my own video clips in their narrative. It's just a quick scene of Ashley Babbitt being rolled out of the Capitol on a gurney on that south side entrance that I was escorted towards as the EMT person was continuing an effort to save her life, along with a quick scene of the bloody trail that was left behind. The producers did not ask for my permission to use that video or even go through appropriate channels, like my agency, to secure licensing for its use. It's just simply not cool. It's not professional on their behalf. Had they asked, I probably would have given them permission and free of charge. I've done so with my other videos. My videos have been properly licensed by use by news agencies all over the world, including the HBO documentary that came out last November about J6. I've also granted use for free to others, those who asked and presented, you know, proper credit in their articles or their podcasts, their documentaries. In fact, there were no acknowledgments whatsoever in the Bloody Hill documentary given to any of the videographers whose work was used in the Bloody Hill, in the closing credit stream that runs, a reel that runs at the end of movies. Just didn't exist. None of us were given credit. So no, I'm not going to sue them, and I'm not going to rat them out to my agency. If Storyful hears about it or learns about it of their own accord, then they can do with it what they will if they so desire. But I'm not going to pursue that. Let me just say this in closing. Calling all the Colbert crew, insurrectionists, or creating content of any kind that either exaggerates or misrepresents the facts of January 6th only serves to harm the credibility of those of us and others who, are independent investigative journalists or working for bigger agencies, as well as harming the credibility and the presentations being developed by defense attorneys who are now working so hard to secure justice for those nonviolent defendants whose freedom and lives are literally now on the line. I mean, especially those who are already imprisoned, who are waiting for this agenda-driven political witch hunt to finish playing out. They all need to be, they just need to be more rational in their coverage and, dare I say, a hell of a lot more pragmatic. But above all else, all of us must be just absolutely deadly accurate in our analysis and our reporting if we are to bring more Americans over to our side as we head toward these very important upcoming trials of so many, completely innocent individuals. And I'm not talking about conclusions or suppositions or just, looking as Senator Ron Johnson's investigators asked me when I was on a long conversation with them. They actually asked me after I presented all the facts of the day to them and their debriefing of what I saw and what I heard and what I experienced that day. They asked me to speculate. And that's a legitimate part of the process. And as you've seen and heard from me today, I've speculated on some pretty intense ideas about what I feel was taking place behind the scenes and up the chain. And I will continue to do so. But those speculations come from a presentation of the hardcore actual facts as I saw them with my own eyes, as I captured them on my own video, as I've been able to accumulate data from multiple and many, many other sources about January 6th. The bottom line is that exaggeration, hyperbole, and misinformation will be, literally laughed out of court. And that's both the courts of public opinion as well as the DC, federal courts where these trials are taking place. Look, Stephen Colbert has long abandoned any pretense of being funny, and we don't need to put ourselves in a position where his audience is now laughing at us because of our inability to be factually correct at all times. Because if we give them even just a sliver, just a, you know, the slightest foot in the door, they'll take advantage of us. And it's not going to allow us to accomplish what we need to accomplish in these coming weeks and months as these trials are, you know, proceeding forward. All right, that's it. So in conclusion, before I get out of here, don't forget, wherever you're watching, hearing, or reading this transcript, maybe just be sure that you, as I mentioned before, subscribe, like, follow, or share. That's really important in helping overcome any and all such, you know, of these reach-restricting algorithms. And please do it now before you forget. And then also, please join our locals community. It's thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. Thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. It's free to subscribe in a read-only format, but you can get so much more if you're able to become a supporting member. So anyway, that's it. Once again, this is Steve Baker, the Pragmatic Constitutionalist. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to bringing you some more information very soon. Thanks. See you next time.